You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Coleman Allen. It's my privilege to be here this morning on behalf of Julia Kane and her infant daughters, Raven and Rihanna Kane. This case arises out of a motor vehicle collision in which the defendant was severely intoxicated and involves three separate errors that in combination caused the case to be presented to the jury from the perspective of punitive damages in a grossly distorted and inappropriate manner. It may be worth taking just a moment to talk about punitive damages from the perspective of its fundamental purpose. I think of punitive damages in some ways as being a little bit like the needle-nose pliers in the toolbox. It's not something that's needed frequently, but on those rare occasions where it is needed, there's really no substitute. The connection between punitive damages and public policy is a very traditional one. It's been viewed that punitive damages arguably serve a broader purpose than compensatory damages do, in that compensatory damages are aimed at making a single plaintiff whole, whereas punitive damages are designed to serve larger public policy purposes.
Mr. Allen, may I ask you this? Would you think the disfavored punitive instruction would be incorrect if we were not in a 8.01, 44.5 situation?
I believe that it would still be incorrect in that it is, in my view, a textbook example of the kind of instruction that this court has cautioned the trial courts against again and again. The instruction adds nothing to instruction number 9, which combines the two VMJI instructions on point. It doesn't provide any definition. It doesn't provide any information. From the standpoint of the things that disqualify it, it checks all four boxes.
Well, obviously, punitives are disfavored. It's not like that's a misleading statement. As you point out, it's a needle-nose plier. You don't need it very often, and you certainly don't pick it up when you need to just turn one bolt. You pick up something else.
I agree with that, but once the court has made the decision to put the issue of punitive damages to the jury, whether that's because the threshold has been met under the common law standard or whether it's statutory punitive damages, I would still view this instruction as not educating the jury in any way, but as being argumentative, confusing, misleading, and prejudicial.
But why do you need to go this far in this case? I mean, your case is not the general tort case. It's the DUI statute punitive case.
That's correct, and I would agree that it is probably more egregious in a statutory punitive damages case, but I would view the instruction as inappropriate in a common law case as well, in deference to the standard instructions given. As noted on brief, this language contained in prior opinions is clearly provided for the benefit of the trial courts in determining whether or not the issue of punitive damages should go to the jury to begin with. Aside from the instructions, there is the error of the court with regard to not permitting the plaintiff to impeach the defendant after he suggested in his testimony that his BAC had been only 0.08 in his encounter with the trooper at the scene. Specifically, the question that was asked at trial, your testimony today is that you were intoxicated at that time. The defendant replied, I wouldn't say intoxicated, I had been drinking. That he was intoxicated is one of the elements, four elements required under statutory punitive damages with regard to refusal. Follow-up question, were you drunk at the time of this collision? Response, that's what my paperwork says, 0.08. Question, your paperwork says 0.08, what paperwork are you referring to? The slip I got today of the accident, and so forth. Beyond that, in closing argument, defense counsel argued to the jury, you heard the evidence as I heard the evidence. At the scene, the defendant performed a breath test. He testified to it on direct examination by plaintiff's counsel. He performed the field sobriety test. He blew at the scene, and he pled guilty to drunk driving. In fact, he blew at the scene of the accident, which resulted in his being charged, which has resulted in his pleading guilty. It would not be appropriate to permit the defense to characterize the testimony I've described by the defendant at trial when asked the question, were you drunk at the time of the collision? That's what my paperwork says, 0.08, to characterize that in closing argument at trial as referring to blowing a 0.08 at the scene repeatedly, and to then, in this court, take an entirely different position and attempt to suggest that that testimony means something different than what it patently means.
Well, was the closing argument is exactly as you said, that they said, the lawyer said that he, quote, blew a 0.08? I didn't see that.
He didn't refer specifically to the 0.08, but he referred repeatedly to performing a breath test. Now, this is a refusal case, so he refused with regard to the test, and that's how the case qualified for punitive damages. But to say repeatedly that he performed a breath test, testified to it on direct, blew at the scene of the accident, is plainly intended to remind and reinforce in the jury's mind his testimony that it had been a 0.08.
Well, his testimony is that the paperwork says, your paperwork says 0.08. That's in response to his answer to a question, 0.082, and then he didn't finish it. Yes. Now, it seems to me that you're on the edge of things that are improper, but I'm not entirely sure that in both cases the needle wasn't threaded very carefully.
Judge, I would look at it from the standpoint, the initial question is, were you intoxicated? That's an element of proof. That's clearly a clean question. When he says, no, I wouldn't say intoxicated, a follow-up question, were you drunk at the time of the collision? Clearly a 100% clean question. The response then comes in, that's what my paperwork says, 0.08. He's introduced the number in front of the jury.
But you're leaving off the two, Mr. Allen, which may add a little context to that 0.08.
He did add two afterwards, and whether he intended to go on and say something more from the standpoint of saying my paperwork referring to his ultimate plea to DUI at 0.08 to 0.14. Now, his actual breath test was 0.25 preliminary test.
Right, but his paperwork does say what he says it says, doesn't it?
It does. But the way he's phrasing it, he is suggesting to the jury that it was a 0.08. And when he says
but
two...
I understand that's your read of it, but if we just look at this cold transcript, it says, that's what my paperwork says, 0.082, and then he stops, yes. And their explanation that he's talking about the paperwork that he gets when he leaves the jail as to what you're charged with, 0.08 to a 0.14, why isn't that as equally as valid a read of what he's referring to as your take that he's talking about the PBT?
Given that this is a refusal case, it's not a situation where there was any plea to DUI or any subsequent test set. So if he received some paperwork later that said something about 0.08 to whatever, it's not relevant to the fact that this is a refusal case. And clearly, that's not part of his answer. That's what my paperwork says, 0.082. He was not cut off at that point.
No, I didn't suggest that he was. He stopped. He obviously stopped. But the question was, were you drunk? The court, I think, heard or understood his answer to be, that's what they charged me with, 0.08 to 0.14, yes, I was drunk.
My response to that would be that he was not, in fact, charged with 0.08 to 0.14. He was charged with refusal, and it was pled down later, exchanging a DUI plea when there was no valid BAC in exchange for null crossing the refusal.
But Mr. Allen, trial courts get to make the opening the door call. I mean, it's an abuse of discretion standard. They've sat through the whole thing. They hear the intonations. They see the body language. Unless it's really clear that a trial judge misunderstood something, we defer to them on opening the door questions, right?
I agree with that as far as the discretionary standard is concerned. However, here, I think it is an abuse when viewed in the total context of the trial, in which he has plainly left an impression with the jury that his BAC was 0.08.
Why don't you ask the court to strike that then?
I don't believe that that bell could have been unrung merely by asking to have that statement withdrawn, as opposed to being able to impeach him when he has suggested that his... The only test...
He didn't suggest that his BAC was that. He suggested his paperwork said that. So it seems like to me the best you could do is get the paperwork and say, does it say that? And it does indeed say that.
My response to that would be where he says, my paperwork says 0.08.
Right.
He's referring to himself having a 0.08. That's clearly what's being communicated. He's not communicating that I was given some papers that had some random language about something I wasn't charged with on it, when the question is, were you drunk at the time of the collision?
Mr. Allen, you know, with the limited time that you have, I would suggest that you get to assignment of error 3.
That's exactly what I'd like to do. Thank you for the suggestion. With regard to admissibility of the evidence of subsequent conduct, you're aware, the defendant's subsequent conduct took the form of a DUI conviction at 0.35 this time, and then appearing 4 consecutive VASAP classes in which he was after drinking and was ejected from the program.
Mr. Allen, you're running out of time.
Yes.
Supposing we were to agree with you in a DUI case, what's the limiting principle?
The limiting principle, as far as statutory punitive, and I believe common law as well, is when the defendant is engaging in the identical same conduct repeatedly.
So that's the principle, the identical conduct, not similar, but identical.
Yes.
Okay.
And the United States Supreme Court has talked in the BMW case about the fact that repetitive conduct is an important factor. And surely it's critical to a jury in being able to know whether or not
punitive damages
are appropriate.
One last question. How would we police this in terms of evidence? Because surely every defendant would be outraged to have subsequent conduct come in on the liability phase. Under your approach, would we have to bifurcate every case involving the potential for after-the-fact punitive information?
No, I don't think that would be necessary in the sense that a limiting instruction can be given by the court if requested by a defendant. I think the fact that the conduct has to be essentially identical, is an important
But how could they get a fair trial on liability if subsequent identical conduct comes in, even with a jury instruction?
Evidence of punitive conduct comes in drinking cases and other cases as well when liability is not yet resolved. And I think, again, it's subject to proper instructions by the court.
So that bell can be unrung.
I'm sorry?
That's a bell that could be unrung, huh?
Yes, I believe so. I believe so, Judge. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. My name is Danielle Giroux, and I represent the appellee, Joe Lee, who is the defendant below. I agree with what Mr. Allen has said regarding punitive damages serving an important public policy purpose, but that has to be tapered with the fact that it is, although a civil remedy has similarities to a criminal penalty, and that is why in Virginia, in the context of a civil case, even in the context of a drunk driving case, punitive damages are disfavored under Virginia law. Turning to his first assignment of error with respect to the instruction that was given, that is an accurate statement of the law.
Well, there's lots of accurate statements that we make in opinions that we never intended to be given to the jury. And I'm concerned that this is one of them.
Well, Your Honor, the statute that the case with the punitive damages claim is relied upon provides it states when such action as an unreasonable refusal may be deemed willful and wanton. But the first paragraph of that statute still says that it's within the discretion of the fact finder. And so the instruction that was given by the court regarding the when punitive damages are to be awarded only in those egregious cases of egregious conduct, that assisted the jury in providing a framework for when they apply their discretion, even if you meet that statute, you have the discretion to award punitive damages. Under what circumstances should they be
awarded? Did it assist the jury counsel, or did it add another element to 44.5 that the General Assembly did not intend in this type of case?
It didn't add another element. I think that when the fact that the statute specifically says that it's still within the fact finder's discretion means that it didn't take anything away from the fact that Virginia has a public policy of saying that these are disfavored except in egregious conduct. And so it just instructed the jury as to how to evaluate whether punitive damages ought to be awarded. This says the plaintiff has the burden of establishing these four factors, which they did. But even if the plaintiff establishes those four factors, it is still within the discretion of the jury to determine whether punitive damages are warranted.
Well, maybe, but the legislature of Virginia has added to the common law remedies by making a very specific statutory remedy, and the word egregious appears nowhere in 8.01.44.5. Nowhere. And so to have one instruction that is accurate, instruction number 9, and then have instruction 10 that could, I think, reasonably be interpreted by a jury as to have added another element, I think the instruction itself is wrong, even if it were permitted to have an instruction like that. What do you say about the notion that this actually adds to the legislature's elements under 801.44.5?
It does not, because it still provides that there is discretion for the jury to decide whether those punitive damages should be awarded at all. So even if all of the elements for unreasonable refusal are met, the jury doesn't have to award punitive damages under
But the statute, if you were going to be consistent with the statute, this instruction would say, if it were properly given in the first place, which I had doubts about, punitive damages are generally not favored and should be awarded only in cases involving willful or wanton conduct shows a conscious disregard for the rights of others. That's what the legislature says is the element.
If the legislature intended to make an exception to the general rule that punitive damages are disfavored and say they should be awarded in every case where there's an unreasonable refusal, where the plaintiff has met all four of those elements, it would have eliminated that first paragraph that provided discretion to the fact finder. But because the jury still has discretion, even if the plaintiff meets all four of those elements, the jury is still left with wondering, well, when do I apply my discretion in awarding punitive damages? And that's where this instruction comes in. So even if you meet those four factors, a jury can still conclude, I don't believe it rises to the level of egregious conduct that warrants punitive damages.
Well, maybe so. Maybe the jury could. But if we approve this instruction, it's not the jury saying it. It's this court saying it. And this court would, in effect, be saying, you know, I realize we had a lot of drunk driving cases and punitive damages issues, and perhaps the legislature didn't like what we were doing. And so they statutorily entered the field, and they articulated the elements, and the Supreme Court now, by approving this instruction, is saying, we don't care what you did. We're going to add another one and tell you we don't think that's a good idea.
I'm really
doubtful about that.
I don't think that's what was intended by this statute, was to completely separate drunk driving cases or unreasonable refusal cases as an exception to that general principle. And even if that were the case, this instruction should not have been given, in this particular case it was harmless error, because the jury did award punitive damages. And the instruction that was given by the court says punitive damages shall be awarded only where there's egregious conduct. The jury in this case awarded punitive damages, so they did determine that the conduct was sufficiently egregious.
So what is the standard of review for us if we believe the instruction is an error? What's the standard of review? Articulate it for me.
It would be de novo. I mean, first you determine whether it's a correct statement of law, and it's reviewed de novo. But then you also, if you find that it was improper, the question is, was it harmless error? And in this case, it can't be.
Well, define the standard for harmless error. What should we be asking? Is it, well, they got punitive damage, end of story? Or is it, does the instruction that was in error, is it likely by a preponderance of the evidence that it had an effect on the award itself?
I do think that's the inquiry, but if you look at the instruction itself and you presume that the jury followed that instruction, it says nothing to the jury about looking to the level of egregiousness to determine the quantum of punitive damages to
but
be awarded.
But any normal person, including perhaps me, would think that that would be what you do. You look at the gravity of the situation. First call is, do I do this at all? Punitives, no punitives. And the very next question is, well, how bad was it?
Well, the jury would do that anyway. Even if you say that they didn't have discretion, if they've met the standard and, yes, punitive damages must be awarded, the jury would still look at the totality of the circumstances to determine the amount of punitive damages. But when you look at this instruction, the instruction itself doesn't say, well, how egregious do you think this was? And you need to take that into account when awarding punitive damages.
That's exactly what it says.
Well, it says that punitive damages should be awarded only in cases of egregious conduct. And so if the jury awarded punitive damages, it met that threshold. So they must have found that the conduct was sufficiently egregious.
And as the two justices before me have said, and then they start looking at, well, how much punitive damages should we award? How egregious is it? And let's make one commensurate with the other.
If they found that his conduct wasn't egregious at all, they would not have awarded punitive damages. But they did find his conduct egregious, and the reason why such a small amount was awarded in this case was more likely the fact that the medical bills themselves for all three plaintiffs combined were only $1,200. And so that's why it's commensurate with the punitive damages award. The punitive damages award is consistent with the compensatory damage award that was given.
So your answer to that question may also illuminate our concern with giving this at all. You said if they found that it wasn't egregious at all, then they would not have awarded punitive damages, which means they would have then disregarded instruction number 9 altogether. We look at it, it's not egregious, forget instruction 9, no punitive damages. Isn't that the very danger that we're concerned with in giving this instruction?
And I would say no, because the statute still allows the jury discretion. The statute itself, in instruction 9, which is based on the statute, still
says... But you just told me if they don't find it egregious at all, then they wouldn't award punitives, which means they would never consider 9.
That's because the statute, as well as the instruction, allows the jury to say, I'm awarding zero damages. It's within their discretion that even if they find the unreasonable refusal was deemed willful and wanton pursuant to the statute, they can still say, I am not awarding punitive damages. The statute gives them that discretion. It doesn't say you must order punitive damages, and then it's up to you to decide the amount of those punitive damages. The statute can be met, and the jury can still award zero damages. The instruction given on egregiousness just provides the jury a framework when deciding whether those punitive damages should be awarded at all. And so, therefore, it wasn't improper for the trial courts to give that instruction.
So in a nutshell, your point is the statute sets a sufficient basis, but not a necessary basis for punitives.
That is correct, yes.
So no trial judge could grant a motion to strike if these facts are shown, or J&OB if these facts are shown, or cut off counsel to argue punitives if these facts are shown. But a jury still has to exercise discretion generally as to whether punitives.
That's correct, yes.
But this is the last question on this subject, but going back to Justice Powell's question, have you really answered her? Because if a jury looks at egregiousness and says, all right, I think I know what egregiousness means, and then gets to the next instruction that says, well, here are things that are, as a matter of law, sufficient to be egregious, as opposed to necessary and ipso facto a verdict, isn't it possible they might read that and say to themselves, in fact, arguable, they may read that and say to themselves, well, I disagree. I don't think this is egregious. In other words, the sufficient floor the jury could blow off. Now, the trial judge couldn't, but could the jury blow off the sufficient floor of the statute?
It could. And it isn't the jury saying, I disagree that these elements that are listed in the statute aren't supportive of willful and wanton conduct. That's not what the jury would be doing. That statute says that if the plaintiff meets those elements, it is deemed willful and wanton. But the statute also says, in its discretion, the jury can still decide whether to award punitive damages. And if the legislature intended for punitive damages to be awarded in every case where the conduct has been proven by the plaintiff to be willful and wanton, it would not have allowed the jury to have that discretion. It would have said, then the jury must determine the amount of punitive damages to be awarded. But this statute allows the jury to still award zero.
Can I change the subject for a minute?
Yes.
Why shouldn't the after-the-fact conduct of a defendant on the sole purpose of punitives, just damages on punitives,
yes,
be relevant if it's exactly the same conduct? Isn't that logically related to the deterrent judgment call the jury has to make?
No. In this case, what we are talking about is conduct that occurred 2.5 years after the accident. And I'm not sure it's specifically relevant. I mean, this is a unreasonable refusal case. It's not any other type of drunk driving case. And whether the subsequent DUI would have had a BAC is sufficiently similar to an unreasonable refusal case.
It's worse.
Arguably, it could be, but you know, if that's the standard, we're talking about two different instances. But the problem with adopting that type of framework is now you're going to have a trial within a trial.
Suppose that can be accommodated with bifurcation and somehow not abused, which would be easy to abuse. But supposing it could be, why wouldn't it be logical?
And that is what some states have done, is that they've done that by statute. They've bifurcated that. But here, even if you allow the bifurcation of that, it's still not relevant to the issue of punitive damages in this case, because the courts have said that what you're punishing is the state of mind at the time of the accident.
But it's not just retribution.
You're
right. It's not logical to retribution, but it is logical to deterrence.
Right.
Which has been in the common law as long as retribution has been.
But what are we deterring? And the case presented by the plaintiffs has to do with that accident and the conduct that occurred within that accident. It's not about how bad the defendant is generally, what other acts he did that are unrelated to this accident. And that's why the cases where they've allowed subsequent conduct still have had a connection to the accident itself. Someone fleeing the scene, for example. That's after the accident, but it's still part of the occurrence. What you don't want is to create an incentive for plaintiffs, for example, to wait to file their cases or wait to serve their cases or delay the trial date as long as they can in hopes that the defendant will make another mistake, because then that would increase the value of your case. The punitive damages shouldn't be dependent on how long the plaintiff waited, hoping that a defendant made another mistake.
What if the evidence were reversed and the defendant had totally rehabilitated himself and become a model citizen, didn't drink another drop, went to meetings and encouraged other people not to drink and drive? Wouldn't that be, for the same reason they want the bad evidence in, wouldn't that be evidence that might be relevant to the deterrence factor?
I don't know.
We don't need to punish this person now because obviously we don't need to deter this type of behavior.
And I don't know the answer to whether a defendant would be able to admit that type of evidence. Had in this case Lee said, I am a changed man, I haven't had a drop, I think certainly that subsequent conduct, even though it's not related to the accident itself, would become admissible for impeachment purposes. But for a plaintiff to introduce evidence that has no connection to this accident at all, nothing to do with the defendant's state of mind at the time of the accident, then puts the defendant in a situation where now he has to present evidence that perhaps the subsequent DUI was wrong, introduce toxicologists, witnesses to say that he wasn't drunk. It's going to create too much confusion for the jury. And if you balance the probative value of that evidence with the prejudicial effect, then it certainly weighs in favor of not allowing that type of evidence. I see my time is up.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen?
Simple logic would tell us that the door should swing both ways, and if the defendant does have the kind of clean record with regard to subsequent conduct, that is admissible and proper argument. It was argued in this case, but it was false because the court had ruled out the evidence of the bad conduct.
Counselor, could I ask you a question? If we agree with you and reverse this case and remand it, is that for a new trial or is it trial just on damages?
trial just on damages, and I would suggest just on punitive damages.
And to further ask the question then, the concerns that Justice Kelsey had about bifurcation resolving some of the liability issues, that wouldn't be a problem if it went back just for damages.
Correct.
Or even especially punitive damages.
Okay. With regard to cases generally, bifurcation is one of the tools in the toolbox of the trial judge, along with a limiting instruction on an individual case and the facts that it may present. In this case, of course, liability was admitted. The four criteria, statutory criteria being met, was not seriously disputed either. And I'm certain in other contexts, courts will have an opportunity to fashion appropriate remedy so that trials will be held fairly.
Mr. Allen, the history of all of this is that the court handed down a number of opinions about punitive damages and drunk driving. The legislature responded with a rather comprehensive statutory response, which I think was intended to loosen it up. My question to you is, who owns this subject now? We have the court's cases, we have the legislature's response, and what you're arguing is that we should further amplify the legislature's response by allowing conduct after the event to come in as evidence, perhaps even with a bifurcated jury to ensure the rights of the parties on the liability question. My question to you is, even if you are right as a matter of policy, why should we do it when the legislature has ventured into this subject in such a detailed manner?
Counsel, I'm not sure whether the Chief Justice pulled the pen out of the grenade before he handed it to you or whether you're supposed to do that.
It's in my hand now, one way or the other. My response would be that this is a rule of evidence, and what is the evidence the jury is going to hear in order to determine the appropriate amount of punitive damages, and involves no intrusion onto territory reserved for the General Assembly. The General Assembly has chosen to exercise its authority in this area in a specific and limited way by providing a shortcut to willful and wanton, the standard at law, by meeting the four criteria. I would view the evidence that goes to the amount of punitive damages and the deterrent part, the public policy part, as being something very much within the scope of what this court has traditionally done and would appropriately address subsequent to the statute.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next case.